Welcome to the Special Sauce Podcast, real conversations about food and life, hosted by Serious Eats founder, Ed Levine.
For me, simple cooking means what is the best version of this dish in as little time as possible, with as few ingredients as possible, and most importantly, with as few dishes at the end as possible.
On this episode of Special Sauce, author Julia Tertian joins me for a revealing conversation about what food and cooking means to each of us. Plus, the Washington Post's Daniela Galarza gives us her take on what defines a simple recipe. It's all coming up on Special Sauce. First up, in our virtual house, is the writer, food justice activist, and podcaster, Julia Tertian. Julia is the author of 4 books, including the latest, Simply Julia. She's also been involved in too many books for us to count. Julia is also the host of the podcast, Keep Calm and Cook On. Welcome to Special Sauce, Julia Tertian.
Thank you so much for having me, Ed. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk to you and to see you on my computer screen.
Yes, exactly. That's the way we see so many people these days, right? First of all, tell us about life at the Tertian family table.
Life at that table was good. What was on the table? What was I eating?
Yeah, like who cooked and what was the vibe?
Until I was 8, that table was in downtown Manhattan. The person cooking in my home most regularly was my babysitter, Jenny, who I continue to be very close to. If Jenny wasn't making something, there was typically takeout on the table. And if we weren't at that table, we were at either like the neighborhood Chinese restaurant or the neighborhood diner. Those were like the two mainstays, sometimes McDonald's, and of course, often a slice or two or five of pizza.
What was your local pizza place?
We lived on West 14th Street, and I feel like on a good day, it was Joe's. And this is crazy to talk to you, of all people, about it. I feel like most slices are good slices if you're having them in New York City.
I always used to say that even bad pizza is melted cheese on warm bread.
Exactly, exactly. I'll tell you a fun fact that I think you'll appreciate. So my mom grew up in Brooklyn, and her parents ran a bread bakery called Rat Chicks on Avenue J, and it was across the street from DeFera's.
I love that.
So when I was older, like more like high school, by this point, my family had moved to the suburbs. I would often take the train into Manhattan. I'd walk to my Aunt Debbie's apartment. She lived really close to Grand Central. And Aunt Debbie and I would get into her car and drive to Brooklyn to see my Aunt Renee, my mom's other sister. We would pick up a pie at DeFera's, bring it to Aunt Renee's apartment. That was like the best day, whenever that would happen.
You know, that means you're like an OG slice eater. That was before, like, any of us had written about DeFera.
Yeah, yeah. No, they knew it because it was the place across the street, not because, you know, Ed Levine made it famous.
So what were your parents' attitude about food? Was it just fuel or were they really interested?
I think it was a little bit of both of those things. You know, my parents were and continue to be very much part of, I would say, like the creative world in New York. They were both in publishing when I was growing up. You know, my mom came from this family that ran a bakery, so food was pretty central to her narrative, I guess. Both my parents really love and appreciate food. My dad now cooks a lot. But growing up, I would say food was a bit more fuel for them. I think that's changed over time. But I didn't learn to cook from my family.
Yeah.
I didn't learn to cook at like my mother's knee or my grandmother or anything like that. You know, my aunts, who I was so close to. My Aunt Debbie was famous for making, in her words, the most delicious reservations.
Like, right.
You know, she just wanted to go out. Her desire was to eat at restaurants. So my love of cooking, I would not say comes from my family, but my love of food, I think, comes from my family and my love of eating.
And how did you get interested in cooking?
I have always wanted to be in the kitchen. As I've gotten older, I've really tried to understand why that is. And I think that for me, it has a lot to do with cooking and being in the kitchen is where I feel safe. And it's where I feel confident. And it's where I feel curious. And I don't know, like all the best things I feel when I'm in the kitchen.
What brought you the most joy when it came to food growing up?
I guess it was, and this feels like it continues to bring me the most joy, it allows me to feel really close to people. When I'm sharing a meal with someone, if I'm cooking for someone, I'm getting to say, like, I feel like I understand you. I see what you like. I'm trying to create it for you. If someone's cooking for me, I feel that in return. If we're going out to eat, it's like, what are we both into? What do we want to get out of this? Like, it feels like this opportunity to really connect with someone. And I find a lot of joy in that sense of connection.
Yeah.
I guess that doesn't have much to do with the food.
Even though everyone says, oh, you know, you're so lucky you made your living through your passions. And it's like, food is fraught with so much meaning for people involved in it. And not all the meaning relates to joy.
Mm-hmm.
It brings up a lot of things. I have struggled with weight issues my whole life, you know, and I think the culture breeds that more than anything. But, you know, my wife doesn't, and my son, they're both super thin, and doesn't matter what they eat, they're really lucky. But everyone in my family struggled with it. And yet it was always a source of joy for me. And that's the contradiction I've never been able to reconcile.
I'm just sitting here nodding because I really hear you on this. And I've read a lot of what you've written over the years about this topic. And I remember reading, like, in the earlier days of Serious Eats, you writing about your weight. And what you're saying really resonates for me. I've had a very similar tension in my life because I have always, always loved to cook. And I have felt those things I shared with you. I've felt confident in the kitchen my whole life. I've felt okay to mess up in the kitchen. I've felt tremendous joy when I make something and have that tangible sense of, like, satisfaction. You know, all these positive feelings happen for me when I cook. I have not experienced those positive feelings when I eat.
Huh.
I have struggled with, I won't say my weight, but I will say my body image for most of my life. And that is definitely something I've inherited.
Mm-hmm.
Not only from my family, but just from our society, from diet culture. And that's something I've been working to really untangle.
So you went off to college, and since you talk about the Hungarian pastry shop, I assume you went to Columbia.
I was across the street at Barnard.
What did you think you were going to do when you graduated from Barnard? Did you set out to become a food writer, or that wasn't really on your radar?
No, it was absolutely on my radar, mostly because I grew up in publishing. I grew up with parents who worked at magazines and who worked on books as art directors and editors. So I definitely saw a future for myself in media. I definitely didn't anticipate where I would be now, by which I don't mean like having published cookbooks. I mean, I've been actively taking a step back from media. I'm currently working at a vegetable farm. I'm like never on my computer. What I studied in college might not be the most obvious route to a career in cookbooks and food media. I studied poetry. I studied creative writing. For me, it actually does make quite a bit of sense because I always had this interest in food, this passion for it, this love of cooking. And for me, studying poetry was studying how to communicate and how to describe things and how to do that in as effective a way as possible, you know, to do it in an economic way, to not go on and on and on. So I think it was a really useful education.
So how did you first start making money in any way related to food?
When I was like in high school, I did some catering, mostly for family, but I had business cards made. I took a week-long bread baking course at the French Culinary Institute when I was in high school one summer. And I also took another week-long course in catering at the new school in this like continuing ed thing. And it met at like some random kitchen in Chelsea. And I was, I don't know, 15 or 16. This is how I wanted to spend part of my summer. I remember the instructor said, if everyone in your life gives you a hard time because you make so many lists of things, you're in the right place. And I just thought, I have found my people. Like, I am definitely in the right place. When I graduated college, I started doing some private chef work. I had never really thought about being a private chef, but that kind of somersaulted and became a big part of what I did for probably the first decade of my life outside of college, on and off.
Really? Wow.
That first family I work for, they gave me a key to their apartment and a credit card. And I got to buy groceries using someone else's money. I got to go to their beautiful kitchen, make food when they weren't at home. They were at work. Their kid was at school. I got to prepare something for them, leave a note how they could heat it up. And then I was off. They're not bothering me. I'm not bothering them. That was like one end of the spectrum. At a different point in my private chef career, you know, I lived with families in places like Montauk, out in the Hamptons and stuff. So, you know, serving dinner parties and stuff. So that was the total other end of the spectrum.
Oh, yes, we know that.
It also allowed me to really understand that what I am first and foremost is a home cook. So whether I'm being paid to cook in someone else's home and make them the food they want to eat at home.
Right.
Or if I'm cooking in my own home, you know, I am a home cook who writes for other home cooks. I created this rule for myself. My rule was, unless someone asked me to make something again, I tried to never repeat anything. And this was just to help me stay creative and stay curious about what I was doing. I basically kept an email going to myself for years where I would jot down notes about like, oh, made this for this group.
Wow.
Picked up this ingredient. You know, I wasn't writing recipes, but I was just keeping notes.
Like a food journal.
Yeah, yeah. And that very much turned into the table of contents for my first book. I had been working with other people on their cookbooks. I had gotten to really know the process of making a cookbook. I had gotten to know a lot of editors. And I felt like I had something to offer, which was this feeling of helping people feel really comfortable in the kitchen. I am not the first person to do this. I hope there will be many, many others who continue to do this. But that is what I think I can offer. I guess what I seek to do in my work is just to help people feel as comfortable as I feel in the kitchen. Because basically, outside of the kitchen, in every other part of life, I feel so anxious, so worried about everything. But when I'm in the kitchen, I feel so calm.
Wow.
And I just want other people to feel that because I know that's usually not the case for people. People feel really stressed out when it comes to cooking.
That's interesting because when I was looking for a common thread in your work, a lot of E words come to mind: empowering, empathetic, encouraging. And all of your books, they're different angles of you encouraging people and empathizing with people and empowering people. So even though you're tackling different subjects, those are the through lines, at least for me.
Mm-hmm. I really appreciate hearing that. That means a lot. I'm glad that's how it feels on your end of it.
Julia, we're finally going to talk about Simply Julia. So how did that book come about?
That book came about pre-COVID. I kept getting the same questions over and over. And what had changed for me since I had put out my first book was that I had gotten to know the people who cook from my cookbooks. I had gotten to know them through book tour, meeting them in person. I had gotten to know them through social media and seeing what they were cooking and the problems that were coming up when they were cooking, whether it was my recipes or other people's. I talked to people about what they're cooking at home all the time. And that group of people had expanded. And I realized I was getting the same handful of questions. And I thought, let me try and answer these questions in another book. And that was sort of the origin of it. And that's how I came to actually organize like the chapters in the book. The first chapter is easy weeknight go-tos, question I get asked all the time. There's a chapter of vegan one-pot meals because I get asked a lot about, you know, people wanting to have more plant-based diets, but maybe feeling a little intimidated about how to prepare that food. So I thought, you know, I'll do a one-pot chapter of all vegan meals. There's also a chapter of all chicken recipes. The through line of all these recipes is they're all recipes for healthy comfort food, which is, I think, the best way to describe the food I cook.
I guess I'd really like you to define simple in your terms when it comes to the recipes in the book.
So for me, simple cooking means what is the best version of this dish in as little time as possible with as few ingredients as possible, and most importantly, with as few dishes at the end as possible. And I don't have parameters or restrictions on those things. Like, something might take hours, but it's hours of unattended time in the oven. You know, you put all the stuff in a pot, put it in the oven.
Right.
And you get like ropa vieja at the end. Or it could be incredibly quick and easy. So I don't have certain time parameters or anything like that.
Or numbers of ingredients or any of that stuff.
Yeah. But that is kind of the framework that I approach all the recipes with. And I think another way to answer that question is, and the way I think of myself as a cookbook author, is I'm a home cook who writes for other home cooks. So I know how much I don't want to wash three bowls if I can get away with just using one. And I know that applies to everyone else too. You know, I think home cooks just are so underappreciated and underrated, and home cooks do so much. Like, we're not just making the dish, we're grocery shopping for it, we're often keeping a budget, we're taking into consideration the other people we're cooking for and what their likes and mostly what their dislikes are, and all those things. We're cleaning up afterwards, we're taking out the trash, we're trying to compost, maybe, you know, we're doing all these things. The cooking is the quick, fun part. So I'm trying to eliminate all the other stuff as much as possible.
You write a lot in the book about various times in your life when you were shy or you felt uncomfortable, that the one thing that was your go-to move in terms of interacting with people was cooking.
Yes. Yeah.
I love that.
It always comes back to food for me. Food has been this amazing tool for me, cooking and food, when it comes to coping with my anxiety. You know, I'll say, in addition to therapy and medication and supportive friends and all that. In college, when I was going to like parties with my friends, which I didn't really do in high school, so that was very new to me, I felt so uncomfortable with the idea of going up to a stranger and saying hello. Like, I was like, how do people do that? I don't understand. And so I would stop at the bodega and get the biggest bag of potato chips that I could find, and I would bring it to the party, and then I just walked around with my open bag of chips, and I would offer people a chip or chips. Who eats one chip? And this became this much more comfortable way for me to just introduce myself. And it was sort of silly, but it worked. And it just gave me a way in to something that felt like I had no idea how to get into that.
So what three recipes should people start with in Simply Julia?
I'm going to say the white pizza style kale, which is just a skillet of like garlicky greens. It could be kale, but it could be anything. It could be a mixture of greens, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then you dot the top of that with some ricotta and mozzarella, throw it under the broiler, take it out, and then shake all the things I would shake on a slice of New York pizza. So garlic powder, dried oregano, red pepper flakes, a little grated Parmesan.
Mm-hmm.
It's so delicious. You could have that with pasta. You could have it with roast chicken. You could have it with some beans. You could have it with toast, eggs. It's so good. It's so simple. It's really fun. So that's the first place my head went to.
Mm-hmm.
The second place is the dessert chapter. There's any frozen fruit and cornmeal cobbler. I love this recipe.
I saw that.
I think I probably make this the most of all the things in the book. There was a while when there was always some of that in our fridge, and I would eat it for breakfast a lot. And basically, you combine frozen fruit, which I think is one of the best ingredients home cooks can have in their kitchen.
It is.
It's usually more affordable. I really love frozen fruit. I'm always talking about it because I just think it's so great. So you toss it with like a little cornstarch, a little sugar, a little lemon juice. Then you make this really simple batter. Like if you can make pancakes, you can make this batter, pour it on top, bake it. It's delicious. And number three, there's a whole chapter of like salad dressings, kind of easy kind of condiments, sauces, that kind of stuff. The stuff that just makes food just taste really good, like a bowl of rice and beans, whatever it is. It just makes it just a little bit more interesting. So in that chapter, there's something I just call my go-to dressing, and it's equal parts of four pantry ingredients. It's olive oil, apple cider vinegar, you could really use any acid, soy sauce, and tahini. So you could do a spoonful of each, you could do a cup of each, you know, whatever the quantity. It's just the same ratio, 1:1:1:1. It's so good. It goes great on everything. There's usually a jar of that in our fridge. It lasts for a long time. I love that dressing.
It sounds like I might have my dinner for the next couple of nights. Well, Julia Tertian, thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us. Serious eaters would be wise to check out Julia's latest book, Simply Julia. And by all means, check out her podcast, Keep Calm and Cook On.
Thank you, Ed. This has been really lovely and a nice opportunity to catch up.
It's time to check in with our colleagues at the Washington Post. Daniela Galarza, the writer and editor of the Post's Eat Voraciously newsletter, gave me the world's easiest segue by writing this week about Julia Tertian and the whole concept of simple recipes. Welcome back to Special Sauce, Daniela. So good to see you. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. You too.
So, Daniela, you know, Julia's new book is called Simply Julia, and the subtitle is 40 Easy Recipes for Healthy Comfort Food. And so you wrote about one of her recipes, but you used it as a way to talk about your idea of simple recipes because so many readers are interested in simple recipes at the moment. So let's talk about your definition of simple recipes for a minute.
Yeah, it's something I think about a lot because I don't think what I think of as simple is the same as what you think of as simple or what my mom thinks of or what my neighbor or my sister. I get a lot of emails from readers of the newsletter. Either they're responding directly to a recipe that I included or they're just asking in general, we're looking for easier recipes. I need easier recipes. You know, they might be parents of young children. Someone wrote to me and said that they were recently ill and they didn't have as much energy to stand up in the kitchen all day. You know, I hear from readers from all over the country and all over the globe, and they are all dealing with similar stresses and strains because of the pandemic. Just last week in Washington, D.C., there was a huge snowstorm, and we found out that grocery store shelves were bare again because delivery trucks couldn't get through the snow. And so people were emailing us saying, like, you know, I can't get this ingredient or I can't get that. How should I make this? How could I make that? So I think we have to think about all of those variables when we create recipes now and try to offer substitutions and adaptations, which we do. But it got me thinking a lot more about what does simple mean in the kitchen and how do we write recipes with that in mind. I think efficiency is a big part of it, and I think a short ingredient list is a big part of it, but I still think it's going to vary from person to person.
And what's interesting is you wrote that simple recipes should contain fewer than 10 ingredients, take just 30 minutes to prepare, rely mostly on pantry staples, could make good use of leftovers, and are very adaptable. In my conversation with Julia, what was interesting was that her definition didn't necessarily mean quick. So talk a little bit about that, because some people think that simple recipes have to be quick, and some people think that simple recipes just have to be simple no matter how long they take.
I think Julia makes a good point. I think that people conflate the two, that simple should also mean quick. Obviously, those two words don't mean the same thing in the dictionary anyway. But yeah, you can think of something like a slow cooker recipe, a recipe where you just dump everything in a slow cooker and you put the lid on and you set the timer for 4 hours and you walk away all day and it does its thing. That's pretty simple. But I've heard from people who say they don't want to leave an appliance on with little kids running around. Maybe they don't have a slow cooker. Maybe they don't want to leave their oven on all day if it's something like a slow roast. You know, I keep the quick in mind just because so many people relate the two. But I think Julia makes a great point. It doesn't always have to be fast.
And I guess also it's the fact that what day of the week are you cooking? Right? If you're cooking Monday through Friday and you have a family or a significant other you're cooking for, or even if you're cooking by yourself, it's different. And then on the weekend when time expands.
Exactly. You know, I think a lot of people are still working from home right now. But I think even then, I cook for a living, right? And I develop recipes for a living. It is still sometimes hard for me to break away from my writing and go into the kitchen and put something on the stove or let's say in the Instant Pot or what have you. So we try to keep that in mind.
You come from years of cooking in restaurants. So you have skills, as they say, and you have chops. That differs a lot in home cooks in terms of the amount of cooking craft that they have. And so how does that relate to the idea of simple recipes?
When I'm developing a recipe, I always add 5 to 10 minutes onto the time that I estimate it takes because I have a number of friends who don't cook or don't know how to cook or didn't grow up cooking. So I think about them when I'm developing recipes because it might take me 30 seconds to chop an onion. I think it would take them 5 minutes. And so I can't assume anything about the reader. I can't make any kind of assumptions about what their knife skills are, even their comfort level with using a knife, their comfort level with putting a pan on high heat. All of those things are things that you can't assume that everyone's comfortable with that. And I don't know, I think empathy comes into the equation a little bit too, just wanting to make sure people are comfortable where they're at.
But even with techniques, you know, it's like some people might not be comfortable with how to do a reduction, or what does it mean to emulsify something? Whereas, like, that's not something you think about. You've internalized those skills. And so do you have to think about that as you develop recipes?
Yeah, absolutely. It goes down to even just, like, dicing an onion, which I think a lot of cooks think is just a basic skill, and a lot of people certainly practice at home, and I think that's great. But I've even gone through recipes and just said, you know what, you can grate the onion. Just grate it on your box grater and then cook it from there. That takes away that initial hesitancy. But I think you're right. I think also reducing a sauce, we think a lot about that in the editing phase of these recipes. I go back and forth with my editors. We talk a lot about how many words do we need to use to describe this technique versus how much can we assume people know what it means to reduce a sauce by a third. You know, do we need to describe the consistency before and after it's reduced? Do we need to compare it to honey or molasses? How do we bridge that gap? And I think that's a constant challenge, but I think it's good that we're thinking about it.
I remember I was always vexed by deglazing a pan. That's the kind of thing where a lot of home cooks really need an explanation of how to deglaze a pan. And so are you mindful of that when you write, so deglaze the pan?
Yeah, I don't think I even use that term anymore. It's interesting. You're absolutely right that when I was in restaurant kitchens, I don't even think I was given that instruction. You were just given a list of ingredients and then you were expected to know how to make the dish. If you got a seared chicken with mushroom shallot and wine sauce, you were just given, like, you know, chicken, shallots, butter, and then white wine at the end. And you knew when you had to add all those ingredients and how to tell everything was done. I think even today, I don't think I even use the word deglaze. I think I'll just say after the food looks a certain color, I'll give visual cues and I'll give approximate times. And then I'll say, and now add the wine or the vinegar or whatever it is and scrape the bottom of the pan until the brown pieces come up. And then you form a nice sauce and say, like, maybe it needs to simmer for a few minutes until it's the texture of, and I give an example, because it's so hard to even explain that without the visual cues.
Why are Julia Tertian's recipes interesting to you? You sounded like you were a fan.
Oh, I'm a huge fan of Julia's. Yeah, I think she's an excellent person, and she's a very smart recipe writer. I think she has an intuitive knowledge of what is going to taste good and what is going to sound good. And in writing a recipe, you know, you can write an easy recipe, but if it doesn't sound good, nobody's going to want to make it. You know, she also knows when a dish is going to look good photographed. You know, she's writing it also with the visuals in mind, which I think is also essential if you really want to get people to make your stuff. But then she's got this concept of efficiency down. So the recipe that you read that was in the newsletter was from, I think, one of her first books, and it was a grain bowl with, let's see, soft-boiled eggs and a simple bit of kimchi sauce and avocado. And it only has, let's see, including salt, 7 ingredients. And it also relies on maybe some leftovers. So it calls for some cooked grains. If you had made rice or quinoa or couscous the night before, a couple days before, this is a great way to use that up. You're at the stove for less than 15 minutes. It requires just a little bit of chopping of the kimchi, but kimchi often comes partially cut up anyway, and it's a soft thing. It's pretty easy to chop, even with, let's say, a steak knife from the drawer. And then she's relying on a little bit of mayonnaise, and that's it. But you use both the chopped kimchi as like a little side to this dish, and then some juices from the jar of kimchi to make a sauce with the mayonnaise. And I just thought that was so smart. You know, she's utilizing every part of that ingredient and using it to maximize flavor alongside these other very simple ingredients.
What's a key tip you can give our listeners if they do make this recipe? What's the one thing that you'd like to impart that will help them and make them feel more comfortable about making the recipe?
I did receive some emails back about this recipe, and those people who hadn't used kimchi before. And in the initial email, I said, well, if you don't have kimchi, you can use sauerkraut or you can use another type of pickle. It's not going to have the same flavor. It's not going to be as spicy, but maybe you don't want it as spicy. Maybe you just need a little hit of acidity and some of that funk that a vinegar-based pickle will bring to a dish, or I should say like a lacto-fermented pickle will bring to a dish. And still people had questions about the kimchi. And so I think the thing that I'll say is that for ingredients that are unfamiliar to people, they should never be afraid to sort of ask questions. But I want people to be curious. You know, even if they've never had something, it might be an opportunity for them to try something new, and they might end up really liking it and seeing how they can use it in other dishes. So yeah, I would say don't be afraid to ask questions about it. Don't be afraid to try something new. If it's something that they can't eat, you know, I think I did hear from some people who said that their doctor told them not to eat any lacto-fermented foods. Then that's fine. You know, I can offer another, like a quick pickle suggestion. They can probably have like a simple dill pickle chopped up with that would be delicious.
You get these questions via email. And so people should know that they can email you, right? So how do they email you?
My email's in the Eat Voraciously newsletter. It's also on the Washington Post website. It's at the top of the newsletter. It's within the newsletter in a few different places. They can email eatvoraciously@washpost.com. But I think they should feel empowered to email any recipe developers. I know Julie is active on social media, and I think that she responds to questions. She certainly has far more readers, and so that could get challenging. But I know that all recipe developers really want to interact with people and want to help them if they can. And so I think that, you know, especially if you're reading a recipe online and the writer's name is there, feel free to email them and ask them questions about it.
And you're pretty responsive, right? People aren't going to wait 3 weeks for a response from you, are they, Daniela?
That's a good question, Ed. I will say I do sometimes get behind on my correspondence. I am now caught up. I'm at inbox zero. So people should try me again if they haven't heard from me.
So now is the time, everyone, to email Daniela. Well, thank you, Daniela Galarza. It's always great to talk to you. And you can sign up for Daniela's free Eat Voraciously newsletter. That's part of the Washington Post. That's it for this episode of Special Sauce. I want to, of course, thank my guests, Julia Tershin and Daniela Galarza from the Washington Post. But before I go, I want to make an urgent plea for Serious Eaters and Special Sauce listeners to do whatever you can to support all links of the food chain, from restaurants to farms to purveyors of everything from meat to fish to cheese. The Omicron variant could not have come at a worse time for all these folks. They desperately need our support. That support can take many forms. Donating to the trade organization, the Independent Restaurant Coalition, at SaveRestaurants.com. Buying food directly from your local independent restaurants rather than using the big corporate delivery apps. Frequenting your local farmers markets or farm stands. Signing up for a CSA this winter, even if it means you end up with more root vegetables and potatoes than you know what to do with if you happen to live like I do in the Northeast. Call 202-224-3121 and implore your local representatives in Washington to support refilling the Restaurant Revitalization Fund. Hundreds of thousands of restaurants were literally and figuratively left out in the cold the first time around. For millions of people who make their living through food, it's beyond crunch time. If you love food, the time is now to do something. So long, serious eaters. See you next time.
Special Sauce is produced by John Kalish and Ed Levine. Our theme music was composed by Charlie Morrow for Morrow Sound.